Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something huge in industries like transportation and agriculture. It's this constant battle, you know? How do you make parts super strong but also like really light? Every bit of weight you can cut from a truck or a tractor, well, that directly helps fuel efficiency, helps the environment too. And the answer, more and more, is these advanced materials, thinner, stronger steels. And today we're really digging into one specific type, high-strength low-alloy steels, or HSLA. You find this stuff everywhere. Car chassis, engine mounts, suspension parts. They're popular because they hit the sweet spot. Really strong, easy to weld, and you can actually shape them pretty well. Allows for lighter designs that are still tough.
Oh, absolutely. Their static strength, just pulling on them once, is genuinely impressive. But HSLA steels have this vulnerability, a sort of Achilles heel, fatigue failure. Yeah. And we're not talking about one big hit causing a break. It's the wear and tear from repeated stress, you know, cyclic loading. It's kind of insidious. In fact, something like 90%, nearly 90% of mechanical failures happen this way, even when the stress seems pretty low, way below the steel's ultimate strength. So understanding low cycle fatigue, LCF, is just critical.
Okay, let's unpack this then. We know they're used a lot, but you're saying there's been a gap in the research. Like, most studies haven't really systematically looked at how they behave when you stress them in different directions. This anisotropy thing.
Exactly. Because parts in the real world rarely see stress in just one perfect direction. So yeah, that anisotropy is key. And that's why our deep dive today is looking at this specific study on HSLA 420 steel sheets. It tackled this gap head on. They tested the material along three main directions: the rolling direction, RD, the transverse, TD, and the diagonal, DD. The goal was basically to figure out how loading direction affects fatigue, where the tiny cracks start, how they grow, and link it all back to the steel's internal structure. It's like materials detective work.
Right. So to solve the puzzle, we need to look at the material itself first. The HSLA 420 steel. What's it actually made of? What did they find when they looked, you know, really close?
Well, this specific one is a commercial ferritic pyrolytic steel. It's hot rolled, about 4.5 millimeters thick. And its chemistry is interesting. Pretty low carbon, but it has these small crucial additions: vanadium, niobium, titanium, manganese, silicon. They're sort of the secret sauce giving it those enhanced properties.
Yeah, the microstructure, like the internal arrangement.
Yeah. If you zoom way in, it's mostly these things called equiaxed ferric grains. Think of them as tiny, roughly equal-sized crystals. They make up about 80% of it. The other 20% is perlite. And perlite itself has this cool layered structure, alternating layers of ferrite and another phase called cementite. The steel's hardness is pretty consistent, around 165 Vickers HV.
Okay, so when they first tested its basic strength, just pulling it until it breaks, what did they find? Anything surprising there, especially with those different directions?
Well, this is one of the first interesting bits you might expect, right? That because the material is rolled and has a texture, it would be stronger or weaker depending on which way you pull it.
Yeah, definitely.
But this HSLA 420 showed surprisingly little directional dependence, at least in its static properties. Whether they pulled it along the rolling direction, across it, or diagonally, the strength and ductility were pretty much the same. The yield stress ratio between RD and TD, for instance, was about 0.9. Very close.
That seems a bit odd at first. Why wouldn't a textured material behave differently in different directions under a static load?
It actually speaks to how it's made. This minimal difference is consistent with its internal crystal structure, its texture, being only moderately developed. It's mostly lined up with the rolling direction.
Yeah.
And that alignment is actually good for formability. It means you can shape it more easily without it cracking or getting weak in one particular orientation. It's designed for that.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, when it did eventually fail under that static pull, what did the failure look like microscopically?
So mostly it was a ductile fracture. You see these tiny voids, little holes forming inside the ferrite grains. They grow and link up. That's pretty typical. But here's a key detail. The perlite, that layered part, it showed cleavage fracture. That's more brittle, like a sudden snap.
So different parts of the same steel fail differently.
Exactly. It shows the different mechanical responses within the material. They also saw tiny intergranular cracks, cracks forming between the grains, especially where ferrite met perlite, likely due to stress building up at that interface. And interestingly, they saw some perlite grains were elongated, which suggests that having finer perlite might actually help the steel to form more before breaking.
Okay, so that's the static picture. But the real story for components is repeated stress, the fatigue. This is where you said it gets really interesting. How does this steel handle cyclic loading? And what about this softening versus hardening?
Right. This is where those directional differences really come into play.
Yeah.
The way the steel responded under cyclic stress varied quite a bit, depending on the loading direction and also how much strain, how much deformation they applied. So, for example, at a low strain level, like 0.1% plastic strain, the DD sample's diagonal actually hardened a little bit initially, maybe 3%, before they started to soften. But the RD and TD samples just softened right from the beginning. Then at a higher strain, 0.3%, the RD and DD samples just softened continuously. But the TD samples transversing, they did something surprising. They initially hardened by about 4% before they began to soften.
Wow. Okay. So it's not simple. What's happening inside the steel to cause this? Hardening here, softening there.
Yeah, it's a complex band, as you said. It really boils down to how the dislocations behave. Remember those imperfections, those wrinkles in the atomic structure?
Right.
Under cyclic stress, these dislocations move, they multiply, they rearrange. Cyclic softening usually happens because they organize themselves into lower energy patterns, like forming walls or cells. Makes it easier for them to move later.
And the initial hardening, like in the TD samples at high strain, what's driving that?
That initial hardening is tied to, well, generating a whole bunch of new mobile dislocations. These interact with the ones already there and also with tiny particles called precipitates. In those TD samples at 0.3% strain, the dislocation density went up dramatically, like 225% increase. It shows the material was really fighting back against that deformation initially.
Almost reinforcing itself. And you also mentioned the DD samples soften less at high strain. What was going on there?
Yeah, that was another interesting observation. In the DDD samples, the dislocations reorganized into these small, quite stable structures called subgrains. Think of them as smaller, neatly ordered crystal regions inside the original grains. They had clean interiors, relatively free of dislocations, and importantly, they seem to be stabilized by those tiny cementite particles we mentioned earlier.
Okay, stable subgrains. How did that compare to the TD samples?
Well, the TD samples also formed subgrains, but theirs tended to contain more internal dislocation structures like veins and tangled messes inside the subgrains. This made their overall substructure less stable. So TD ended up softening more significantly over time compared to DD, even though it hardened initially.
This is really intricate stuff. It leads us to something called the cyclic stress strain curve and this term N-prime, the cyclic strain hardening exponent. You said the study found something deeper here.
Yes, this is where it gets really fascinating. They found what they called double N-prime behavior, but only in the TD and DD samples.
Double N-prime, what does that mean?
Okay, so the RD samples showed a pretty consistent hardening behavior across different strain levels, one N-prime value. But for TD and DD, the way they hardened seemed to happen in two distinct stages. If you plotted their stress response at midlife, the curve had two different slopes. For instance, in TD, the N prime value was low, like 0.076 at low plastic strains, but jumped way up to 0.35 at higher strains.
So it's like the material's ability to toughen itself up changes depending on how hard you're pushing it.
Exactly. Its hardening capability isn't constant. It shifts gears, you could say, depending on the deformation level.
And they could actually measure this change afterwards, right? Using hardness tests.
Precisely. They did micro hardness tests on the samples after the Fatin tests were done, and the results lined up perfectly. Hardness generally increased with more plastic strain, which you'd expect. But at that high 0.3% strain, the TD samples ended up the hardest around 217 HV. Then came DD at 200 HV, and RD was lowest at 186 HV.
So TD, DD, RD, and hardness.
Yep. And that hierarchy perfectly matches the changes they saw in the N-prime exponent. It confirms those internal structural changes were making the material physically harder, especially in the TD direction at high strains.
Can we break down how it's getting harder? What are the main mechanisms?
Sure. There are two main things happening. One is Hall-Petch strengthening. This comes from making the grains, or in this case, the subgrains, smaller. More boundaries mean more barriers to dislocation movement.
Like building with smaller bricks makes the wall stronger.
Kinda, yeah. The other is dislocation force strengthening. This is just about the sheer density of those dislocations. The more tangled they are, the harder it is for others to move through the forest. So in those TD samples at high strain, the original fairy grains were subdivided into much, much finer subgrains, maybe from 5 micrometers down to just over 1 micrometer. This hugely increased the Hall-Petch effect. And at the same time, the dislocation density just skyrocketed. So you get this powerful combination, the synergistic effect, driving that intense cyclic hardening we observe specifically in TD at high strain.
Okay, so we have this complex picture of hardening and softening, different in each direction. But ultimately, what matters most is how long the material lasts, right? The fatigue life. How does all this translate into lifespan? You mentioned the Coffin-Manson relationship.
Right. And this is probably the most critical finding for anyone designing with these steels. The transverse direction, TD, specimens consistently across all the strain levels they tested had the shortest fatigue life.
How much shorter?
Significantly. Yeah. At low plastic strain, the RD samples lasted almost twice as long as TD. Even at the high strain level, RD still had about a 25% longer life than TD.
Wow. And DD, the diagonal.
DD was interesting. At low strains, it behaved much like RD. Quite good fatigue life. But at higher strains, its fatigue life dropped and became closer to the poor performance of TD.
And you mentioned something odd about that Coffin-Manson plot for TD and DD. It wasn't a straight line.
That's right. For RDD, the plot relating strain to fatigue life was pretty much linear, which is often expected. But for TD and DD, it showed this clear bilinear trend, like the line bent at a certain point.
A kink in the curve.
Exactly. And importantly, this wasn't because of different phases acting up, which you sometimes see in other types of steel. This suggested a more fundamental shift in how the material was failing.
Okay, so if it wasn't phase differences, what caused that bilinear behavior, that shift in failure mode?
It seems to reflect a change in what's dominating the fatigue damage process. At those lower plastic strains, deformation is quite localized. So fatigue life is mostly determined by crack initiation, how easily those first tiny cracks start.
Where the first domino falls, basically.
Pretty much. But as you increase the strain, plastic deformation spreads out more. And then crack propagation, how fast those initiated cracks grow, becomes the main factor controlling the fatigue life. And this propagation seems strongly linked to the formation of those subgrains we talked about.
So let's picture the cracks themselves. At low strain, what did they look like in RD versus TD?
Okay, low strain. In the RD samples, the cracks mostly started inside the ferric grains, intragranular cracking. And quite often, they'd get stopped when they hit a grain boundary. Those boundaries acted as pretty good barriers.
That sounds good for longevity. What about TD?
In TD samples, again at low strain, the cracks preferred to start right at the grain boundaries, intergranular cracking. This fits with what we saw earlier. Dislocations piling up and subgrains forming near those boundaries, weakening them. TD also just had more cracks overall, a higher crack density, and crucially, more of its cracks were already quite large, suggesting propagation was more aggressive right from the start compared to RD.
And what happened at higher strains, say 0.3%?
At higher strains, RD still showed more cracks staying small, trapped within grains, and it had a sort of mixed failure mode cracks going through grains and along boundaries. But in the TD samples at high strain, the cracks overwhelmingly followed the grain boundaries, a much clearer intergranular fracture mode. And this is where those aligned subgrains seem to provide easy paths for the cracks to run along.
Okay, this leads us to the final piece of the puzzle. The study identified a specific feature, a sort of hidden culprit, especially for the TD direction's weakness. What was it?
Yes, this was perhaps the most significant insight. It all came down to intergranular cementite particles.
Cementite again, but I thought cementite was part of perlite, which helped strength.
It is. And cementite within the perlite layers does help. It pins dislocations, adds strength. That's the good cementite, if you like. But the problem arises when cementite particles are located along the main grain boundaries or even along the boundaries of those subgrains that form during cycling.
Ah, so location matters.
Critically, cementite sitting on these boundaries seems to do the opposite of strengthening. It reduces the boundary's ability to accommodate those dislocations piling up. It weakens the boundary's resistance to cyclic stress. So this intergranular cementite acts as a preferential site for cracks to start and grow, especially at higher strains. It's like a weak link in the chain, and it seems to be a major reason why TD performs so poorly in fatigue.
Wow. So if we tie this all together, this deep dive really highlights something crucial. It's not just about having a high-strength steel. How you orient that steel and these really subtle microstructural details, like exactly where the cementite particles end up, can make a massive difference in how it handles fatigue, how long it actually lasts in the real world.
Absolutely. For engineers in transport, agriculture, anywhere, using HSLA steels for lighter, stronger parts, this is vital information. Understanding these directional weaknesses and the role of features like intergranular cementite is key. It means you can potentially design better components by considering the loading direction relative to the steel's rolling direction, or maybe even look at processing methods that minimize that harmful intergranular cementite. It's about controlling that internal architecture.
Which leads to a fascinating thought, doesn't it? If we now know that the precise location of these tiny cementite bits can be the Achilles heel, what's next? Could we see new steel manufacturing techniques designed specifically to control where cementite forms, maybe pushing it away from those critical boundaries? Could that lead to even tougher, longer-lasting materials for the future? Something to think about.